There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to Your Booked, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host and the author of The Sisterhood, a love letter to the women who have shaped me. I'm delighted to bring you a very special festive live episode. This Your Booked bonus was hosted by Albright Mayfair, a members club focused on creating opportunities for women in business. And we have three fabulous women who mean serious business. Dolly Alderton, Sunday Times columnist, host of the magnificent High Low podcast and author of the smash hit memoir, Everything I Know About Love. The novelist, Aisha Malik, the creator of beloved literary heroine, Sophia Khan, and author of one of my favourite books of 2019, This Green and Pleasant Land. And Lissa Evans, who writes brilliant books for adults like Old Baggage and Children, Wed Wabbit, and whose novel, Their Finest Hour and a Half, was adapted into a feature film starring Gemma Arterton and Bill Nighy. Once I'd rounded up our A-listers and bribed them with selection boxes, I had some serious questions to ask them. What's the epitome of cosy Christmas reading? Which characters should get lumps of coal in their stockings? And just why did Rod Stewart end up serving his guests so many turkeys? All would be revealed. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Your Booked. Thank you so much for joining us today. I am so excited for this Christmas special because I have some of my all-time favourite writers up here alongside me. I'm so excited that I can't get into my stool.
There we are.
Hooray! So I'm Daisy Buchanan and I'm the host of the Your Booked podcast. Usually we go into the homes of authors we love and we interview them beside their bookshelves. Today's a little bit different. Here I have Dolly Alderton, Sunday Times columnist, host of The High Low, author of the best-selling Everything I Know About Love. She's got a novel coming out in 2020 and I am desperate to read it. So desperate that I'm trying to work out a way to hack her laptop. No luck so far, but I'm going to keep at it. Also have brilliant Aisha Malik, who has written lots of books. Like she's the author of the Sophia Khan series. She wrote one of my favourite books of 2019, This Green and Pleasant Land, which is a very funny, very dark, but very sweet exploration of a culture clash and what it means to be English and the complicated things that happen when we start to talk about otherness. That's another book that I'd recommend very strongly. Also, Lissa Evans, the fabulous, funny, best-selling author of many books, including Old Baggage, which is one of the books that's come up the most on the podcast. I've seen that on so many shelves of our guests. Lissa is, we've not run her episode yet, but it is one of the funniest, and Lissa got one of the best. There were books that I saw on your shelf that just, you know, books that I will wonder whether I dreamed them or not, and I'm so glad that they're real. But also delighted to see you in, is it Kenneth Williams' diaries you are mentioned in?
Oh, wow.
So that was very exciting. Coming in 2020. So as it's a Christmas special, the first question I have for my fabulous panel is, what do you read to get you in the mood to get really, really Christmassy? Dolly, I will start with you.
A book that always makes me feel Christmassy is Little Women.
Oh, you stole my answer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You always go first.
I'm sorry. But you know what? I was rereading it over the weekend, and I do think that it has the most joyful and beautiful Christmas passage of any book that I've read, which is the scene on Christmas morning, quite early on in the book, when they wake up and they're being very excitable and bratty, as we all are on Christmas morning, and they want to kind of stuff their faces and open all their presents. And then their mum comes home, Marmee, and says, I've just been visiting these very poor people, where I think there are six children and they're all frozen and they've got no food and they've got no wood for the fire, and they decide to take their Christmas breakfast over as their Christmas present. And I just think it's such a beautiful story of the joy that comes from being loving and compassionate and sharing. And they end up saying it's kind of their most joyful Christmas they've ever had. Don't get any ideas. I want to keep all my Lindor to myself. And all my presents are for me. But I very much admire the March sisters for their philanthropy.
Well, famously, the first line of Little Women is, Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents, which I was like, not so Christmassy for me. Quite a bold choice, but a strong choice. Now, Aisha, is there anything you'd like to add about Little Women? I know there was another book that has come up.
So I won't add anything about Little Women, but that is my all-time favourite to reread during Christmas, which I don't celebrate, by the way, so I'm a great guest to have on this panel. But otherwise, Harry Potter, because it appeals to the soul, you know? Because it's about friendship and love and good and evil and... it's got lots of great food descriptions as well. Harry Potter for me.
I mean, quite honestly...
Specifically the third one,
Prisoner I would read a whole novel that's just Christmas at Hogwarts. I don't want anything to happen. I want no peril, no drama.
Me too.
I just want that, the setting of the scene.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Are there any favourite bits of Christmassy magic that you can remember?
No.
Just putting you on the spot there.
And I did tell Daisy I don't like being put on the spot, so thank you.
That's my gift to you.
Merry Christmas.
Lissa, I will ask you.
Well, I had a big think about this, because I really don't like Christmas very much.
You put together a terrible panel, Daisy.
three weeks of bloated gloom. I thought that the books that I like best reading Christmas are books that make me grateful for being indoors and warm and all that. So what I really love is books about people struggling through snow and ice and suffering dreadfully. And so my favourite Christmassy books are things like absolutely Cherry Garrard's The Worst Journey in the World, which is he was on the Scott expedition and went and crossed the Antarctic during the Antarctic winter. But I think my favourite of all is a book that I very often read at Christmas, and it's by Annie Prue, and it's called The Shipping News. And it's one of my favourite ever books, and it's about... and it does get vaguely Christmassy, so bear with me. It's about a rather lumpen, sad man called Coyle, whose life is pretty disastrous. He's always taken advantage of. He's got married to a woman who despises him. He's got two small children he adores. And his wife dies, and he decides to start again. And he goes back to the place where his family came from, which is Newfoundland, an island off the coast of Canada, where it's freezing, where it's ice and snow, where the sea lashes the land, and there he starts again, and there he fits in for the first time. And it's a book about warmth, and it's about family, and it's about being freezing outside, and it's very funny. And also, it's a book that my mum used to read about once a year. So when I read it, I feel like I'm having a conversation with my mum, who's long gone. So that's my favourite Christmassy book.
I do think at Christmas it's a really good time to read, you know, people in adverse circumstances dealing with hardship, because that's what makes a great novel.
And
I think
it.
Christmas, more than ever, it's when we sort of look at everyone else and everyone seems to be, you know, doing great and having a wonderful time. So I'm going to read that and remember that when I'm, you know, looking through Instagram and wondering why my tree doesn't look like the other trees.
Speaking of hardship at Christmas, I've just seen an opportunity for me to jump in with my reading, Daisy.
Hooray!
From Rod Stewart's autobiography. I was thinking...
Just to check, are we going to have to give Rod Stewart any money when this is on the podcast?
Oh, God, I don't... I mean, the amount of blood... All I do is talk about Rod Stewart publicly, so frankly, he should be giving me royalties. So this is from his... from the section near the end... where he's talking about life now after he met Penny Lancaster. And he's talking about all his ex-wives, of which there are a lot, and he has lots of children with all these women.
Relations between us all have been so stable that in 2000 we felt close enough, at my suggestion, to hold a big family Christmas. It took place at Celtic House. Christmas dinner for all the children, Alana, Kelly, Rachel and Penny. So that's his ex-wives and his current girlfriend, whom I'd only been seeing for a few months and for whom this must have been uniquely terrifying experience. Thrust into a room with the three variously formidable mothers of her new partner's children, who'd never been together in this way and in the volatile circumstances of Christmas too. There was some competitive turkey cooking in the kitchen. This bit's quite weird. It was generally agreed that Alana's turkey turned out best. So they all cooked their own separate turkeys, competitively, like Ready, Steady, Cook, while Rachel had ruined hers by throwing it at every single herb she could find. Kelly did the roast potatoes and the sprouts. Penny, very cannily, stood back and let them get on with it. Everybody got along well enough, and the children, of course, loved it. Was it the kind of Christmas that adults in the party would choose to have every year? Perhaps not. Have we done it again since? No. But I was able to look around the room during that afternoon and cast my eyes from one face to the next and think to myself, okay, maybe you wouldn't have sat down and planned it this way, and Lord knows there was enough grief and strife along the road, but in a profound and unshakable way, this family is a unit, and it works.
I do have a Christmassy reading with me, actually. Shall I? Do you want me to do that now?
Or
do you want to move on?
Let's go for it.
Because it's an antidote to that, because there was...
Nice sense of balance on this panel, at least.
It's a very simple story. There was a book that I read and reread as a child called A Country Child by Alice Nutley, who later on wrote things like Sam Pig and that kind of thing. But she grew up on a farm in Derbyshire as an only child, and it was a very simple life, and she was well looked after. They weren't short of money, but it was very basic. And I used to love reading, and this is perhaps why I don't like Christmas, because my Christmas is never anything like the Christmases I read about in books.
I'm going to guess that this isn't someone who's having to eat four different kinds of turkey.
It isn't indeed. It's her opening her stocking in the dark, in her own little room, in a Derbyshire farm in about 1900. She pinched the stocking from the toe to the top, where her white suspender tapes were stitched. It was full of nice knobs and lumps and a flat thing like a book stuck out the top. She drew it out. It was a book, just what she wanted most. She sniffed at it and liked the smell of the cardboard back with deep letters cut in it. She ran her fingers along like a blind man and could not read the title, but there were three words in it. Next came an apple with its sweet, sharp odour. She recognised it, a yellow one from the apple chamber and from her favourite tree. She took a bite with her strong white little teeth and crunched it in the dark. Next came a curious thing, pointed and spiked with battlements like a tower. Whatever could it be? It was smooth like ivory and shone even in the dark. She ran her fingers round the little rim and found a knob. She gave it a tug and a ribbon flew out. It was a tape measure to measure a thousand things, the tree's girths, the calf's nose, the pony's tail. She put it on her knee and continued her search. There was a tin ball that unscrewed and was filled with comfits, and an orange and a sugar mouse, a sugar watch with a paper face and a chain of coloured ribbon, a doll's chair and a penny china doll with a round, smooth head. Finally, there were walnuts smelling of the orchards at Birding Bush Farm, and a silver shilling, the only one she ever got in very great wealth. That's it. Sweet, isn't it? Sweet, isn't it?
I think you are quite Christmassy.
Or you will be by the end of this panel.
Never like that, you know. I don't know. You know what the ordinary family Christmas is like? Children shouting at each other and sort of competitive stocking opening.
But when you were, say, 9 or 10, and you were, I don't know if you had stockings or not, but if you found gifts at the end of the bed and you pulled out a book and it was just what you wanted most in the world, what would that book have been?
Oh, gosh, I love books so much. It's too hard for me to say. A book in which ordinary children stumble across magic. That was always my favourite sort of book.
Oh, so maybe a bit of E.B. Nesbitt or E. Nesbitt. Have I given her an extra B? She was a Belinda. Aisha Dolly, same question. In your present acquiring youth, at a time when you were too small to be polite about gifts and you reacted to them very strongly, you pull a book out of your stocking or wherever presents are kept, what do you most want to see on the cover?
Well, my family never celebrated Christmas, so this is a sad question.
All right, well, it's your birthday.
No, I'm joking, because actually I think my parents used to feel so sorry for us that we didn't celebrate Christmas because we were Muslim. Not were Muslim, we still are. I did used to actually get presents because I was a bit spoiled.
This is sounding quite a lot like celebrating Christmas to me.
Yeah, do we not? I mean, I'm still not quite sure. And I remember my dad got me a copy of all the Disney cartoon stories, a collection of Cinderella, Lady and the Tramp, Dumbo, and I loved it so much.
So were they illustrated?
Yeah, they were illustrated, and I remember I used to, as a child, I used to sit down and I used to rewrite the stories by hand because I had no imagination of my own, so I just copied Disney stories. It was really sweet. I was a really sad child.
Oh, hang on. So you weren't adding to that? You were just writing?
No, it's a comprehension exercise.
Yes, yes. Exactly. Yeah.
I bet you had beautiful handwriting.
No, it was shit. I did try, though.
I think mine would have been the official Spice Girls fan club book. Or I remember being very excited and specifically requesting, there was a magazine called Girl Talk.
I remember Girl Talk. Did you have the first issue, the choker, the black choker with the silver flower?
Yes, I did. And there were all those posters that you would get inside that were basically a million different variations of a bunny with a flower on its head.
Yes.
And I loved that. And I remember they brought out like an anthology that I definitely would ask for every year that was basically just a hard copy of lots of bunnies with lots of meadows on their heads. And I just, it made me so happy. So I think that probably would have been my favourite books to open at Christmas.
I remember once in my stocking, and now I look back on it and think, this is kind of a creepy book, but I loved that book so much, and I still do. And I can't remember the author, so if anyone wants to shout it out, Daddy Longlegs, which they made a film
that's
of.
That's a great book.
And I had this, do you remember who wrote it?
No.
You're going to say it and I'm going to... but it was this green kind of linen cover. And I also got this really... Oh, I had a real... I don't know why, because they're not a child-friendly sweet. I was odd. But these bonbons, you know the toffee ones, they've got loads of icing sugar on them. And having this really, really beautiful book and ruining it by getting it covered in like bonbon dust. But it's all about this orphan, Jerusha Abbott, and she is living at the horrible orphanage, the John Grier home. Isn't it weird how I can remember that and not who bloody wrote it? And when she's 17, she is sent to a fancy sort of private ladies' college in the East Coast, somewhere in Massachusetts, by a mysterious benefactor, and she doesn't know who. And I'm not going to tell you because it's a bit of a spoiler, but the end of the book is... Really, really, I was transported by the story. Problematic when you look at it with 2019 eyes.
Oh boy, is it problematic when you look at it now? Yes, it really is.
But it's all about her making her way in the world and having independence for the first time. And she's got an allowance and it's not as much as the other girls, but it's like riches to her. And she has her own room and she can't believe it. And there's a part where she uses her... She has, I think it's a chest of drawers, and she makes it into this window seat by pulling out all the drawers and climbing up with books. And she can watch the snow falling out of the window. And I have broken so much furniture and I've... hurt so many limbs. No chest of drawers can bear my weight, and that is my tragedy.
I love a mysterious benefactor story, and I think that's one of the reasons I like Little Women, because there's that lovely Mr. Lawrence next door who throws her a piano. And to this day I'm still waiting for my mysterious benefactor, to the point that there was a period of my life in my early 20s where I was like constantly had £3 in my NatWest current account, where if I saw a number come up that I didn't know, I was like, it's the lawyer of a mysterious benefactor. And I would pick up and I'd be like, hello? Just waiting for someone to say, did you know of an elderly man called Mr. Greenfield? And I would say, no. And he'd say, well, he knows of you and he's been a great admirer of your work for many years. He would like you to have his house in Cheyne Walk.
Where is it? It was NatWest, calling.
A similar fantasy when in my language lessons at school, for some reason, somebody had put a series of... posters of Italian castellos around the wall, and there was one called the Castello di Monselice, and I had I had a dream during German, which is why I didn't learn any German at all, that I would get a letter saying you've been left the Castello de Monsalice. And I used to dream walking along the ridiculous. I still feel somewhere, it's mine.
Yes, yes. Sometimes I just, like, on low days, treat myself to those, like, fantasies. Just 3 minutes. I just imagine the phone call or the letter.
Well, do you know there's a Dorothy Parker short story I love, and it's either called The Cost of Living or The Price of Living, but it's about that these two girls do that. They spend the whole lunch hour walking around Manhattan, fantasizing and playing this game. It's like, say there's this old man, you don't know him, he's just seen you around, not in a weird way, but just thought, oh, you know, someone should do something nice to that girl, she seems lovely. And he dies peacefully in his sleep, leaving her $1 million.
It's always for no reason. I can never think of a reason why they want to give me everything, but it's like it's a legitimate reason, but I just don't know why.
I often think if I came into money, this is way off the book chat, but one of the things I'd really like to do is I would go round, I'd log into on John Lewis, I'd try and hack into people's wedding lists, and I'd buy the most expensive thing for everyone, and never, I'd just be like, you know, good luck, lots of love, but I'd never say what, they'd never know. They'd be like, what was that?
I love that. And that is actually very Christmassy behaviour.
All right, let's bring it back to Christmas and books. I'm giving you all an unlimited budget, and you have to, but you can buy a book for every single person, you know, in the country or in the world, but it has got to be the same book, and it can't be your books.
That's shit, isn't it?
Can you imagine that? Sorry. Would be like when Chris Rea went on Desert Island Discs and every song he chose was his own songs.
Every song?
Every single one.
Because he got money, weren't they? So what book are you buying for the world for Christmas or winter time? This wasn't on my list.
No,
it's just something I thought of.
Stumped, yeah.
So I've stumped you all.
You start, Aisha.
Oh no. You start, Dolly.
I get everyone any human heart because correct response. Because I think it's perfect for winter because it's so absorbing. And it covers, more than any other book I've ever read, the whole spectrum of a human life. And I've never read a book that so accurately and evocatively and movingly takes a kind of stab at what it must be like to live a whole life from start to finish. And I just find that such a moving thing to experience. So I think it's like the best book ever written, but also just a perfect winter book.
I've decided I would send everyone the non-fiction book by Susan Cain called Quiet, so that everyone just shut up. A, and B, because it's a book solely for introverts living in an extroverted world, and because being an introvert myself, it's quite, as you can tell, it spoke to my soul, and it was very nice to have a book that was just written for people who suffer from introversion in an extroverted world, and also how to cope in a professional setting, in a social setting, and how to embrace it rather than become a part of the whole product of extroversion. So there we are.
Both excellent answers. Lisa?
Okay, I'm going to go for a short novel. It's almost a novella, really, called A Month in the Country by J.L. Carr. Which I think is more or less a perfect book. I talked about it for a podcast two or three years ago, and before we started the podcast, I said, does anybody know how long this book is? And we checked, and it's 20,000 words, and yet it has everything in it. It starts with a young man getting off a train in Yorkshire. It's the end of the First World War. He's got sort of twitch from his time in the trenches. He's there in this Yorkshire town to exercise his craft, which is uncovering wall paintings. And the local church has got a wall painting that has been painted over, and he's there to uncover it. And in the next field is a man who's doing an archaeological dig, and it's the same thing, he's another war veteran. And over the course of 3 months, our hero falls in love, falls out of love, rediscovers himself, finds how to live again, and also uncovers this extraordinary wall painting. As much as anything else, it's a book about craftsmanship and about art, and it's completely satisfying, completely wonderful, and then he leaves. It's almost the antithesis of any human art. It's a tiny snapshot of a life, but just so readable and so gorgeous.
Also, in 20,000 words, I now want to read that. Yes. As someone who's such an overwriter, that's such a skill, isn't it?
Amazing. It's a wonderful book. I don't know anybody who hasn't liked it. So there we go. That's my
and
tip.
I imagine a great book to give to the world if, you know, there are reluctant readers who, I think, I sometimes feel really daunted by a big book. So, you know, that's it's like knowing a film is under 90 minutes. I'm like, yes, yeah. I will go to that. Yeah. I can invest that much. I did want to talk to you all about food in books and anything that you people eat in books that you like to eat in the winter.
I just have a really steady diet of Nutella. And actually, I don't think there's any book that's been written that really celebrates Nutella in the way that it should be celebrated.
There's a gap in the market there, babe, for you. Next book. I remember when I was little, my mum used to read me the Millie Molly Mandy stories.
Yeah,
and I remember that I remember reading them in the winter, and I remember reading about potato lids, which were baked potatoes with the top cut. My mouth is going to start watering. And then all the potatoes scooped out and then mashed with cheese and butter and then put back into the potato with the lid put on.
We have that virtually every weekend. Yeah, it's a kid's favourite. Yeah.
Go around, so listeners, yummy. And have some lids.
Yeah, can I come live at your house? Yeah.
I was thinking about this, and there's a fantastic bit in What Katie Did at School. I was a real What Katie Did fan. And in What Katie Did at School, Katie, who by the second book is an absolutely perfect pain, really. But nevertheless, she goes to a boarding school with her mate, with her sister Clover. And they're all snowed in winter, and none of the Christmas parcels get through, apart from Katie's family's sent two boxes, and they get through. And there's a wonderful description of what's in the box. But what used to really strike me as somebody who likes their grub was the passage, "The top of the box was mostly taken up with four square paper boxes. Each box held a different type of cake. One was of jumbles, another of ginger snaps, a third of crullers, and the fourth contained a big square loaf of frosted plum cake with a circle of sugar almonds set in the frosting. All I wanted was crullers. I had no idea what they are, but by God, I wanted crullers. And I've looked them up, and they're kind of fried pastry twists. Have you had them?
Yeah.
Sort of dusted with icing sugar. So crullers, jumbles, brandy snaps. That's what I required.
Kind of underwhelming, though, aren't they, in the end? Crullers.
I think everything that you've imagined, you know, what it could never live up to what you hoped it would be in your head. But oh my goodness, there is nothing more satisfying than not just delicious food, but food you're unpacking in a box. It's food, it's a present. It's not necessarily Christmassy, but one of my favourite food bits in any book is I think it must be in the first Bridget Jones book, where because she's going out with Daniel Cleaver at the time and having Jude and Shaz around, and they always have many bottles of Chardonnay, whole boxes of dairy milk, M&S salmon pinwheels, lots of a full sort of like M&S luxury convenience food buffet, like everything in the chiller cabinet. And I've always having, you know, and I shouldn't complain, but, you know, having a mother who sort of likes to make things and abhors convenience food. My part of my grown-up fantasy Christmas was, you know, all of the frozen canapes. Yeah.
Daisy and I often bond over things that we love about the 90s, one of which is pine nuts.
You can't overuse the pine nut.
Something happened to pine nuts, though. They're just not chic anymore. You don't see pine nuts anywhere. But we
you don't
go
see
back.
Pine nuts anywhere because they're all in my cupboard.
We want to go back to the 90s. We want to wear lilac. We want to shop in Agnes B. We want to listen to a bit of Wet, Wet, Wet and eat some pine nuts.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We'll be back to Dolly, Aisha and Lissa soon, but now it's time for my festive steal of the week. Guard it with your life, or it will go faster than the purple quality streets. This week, I've chosen a Christmassy book that I adore by one of my favourite writers and a former guest. It's An Almost Perfect Christmas by Nina Stibbe. It's a collection of essays and short stories about playlist politics, the pain of having Santa for a stepfather, and the do's and don'ts of Christmas dinner. Don't name your turkey while it is still alive. Do have a go at defrosting it with a Philips hairdryer. That's An Almost Perfect Christmas by Nina Stibbe, published by Viking and out now. Now back to our guests. Christmas, or, you know, this period, a lot of time with very close friends and family. That can be the best of times and that can be the worst of times, to use a very clunky literary allusion. You need to get someone in your house off your back for a few days. What book do you give them?
For me, the book that I think is the most absorbing that I've probably ever read, and I read it during quite a tough time in my life, and then I lent it to my sister, who is very, very highbrow, and she wouldn't even answer the phone for 3 days because she was reading it, is a book by Stephen King called 221163, and it is phenomenal. It's not one of his horror ones. It's a book, basically, somebody tries to go back in time to stop JFK being killed. It sounds completely mad, but it is fantastic. If you want to push the world away, if you're going through, you know, difficult time or hospital tests or anything like this, read 221163 because it's absolutely brilliant. So that's my tip.
I'll definitely buy that. I've never even heard of that book.
And I love, you know, because I really like Stephen King as a writer, and I love his early work, but no, I'm not wild about horror. So non-scary Stephen King, right up my alley.
Tension.
My family doesn't really read.
True story.
They don't really read, but if they did, I mean, it took my mum a year to read my first book, and even after that, she was like, it was okay. So, tough crowd. But I did once give my sister a book called How to Kill Your Husband, and she enjoyed that thoroughly. Maybe got a few tips.
What's it about? Is it a novel or a manual?
I think it's a kind of manual come novel type thing. It was quite a few years ago now, but she enjoyed it very much.
Is it funny or just very macabre?
He's still alive. So obviously wasn't as useful as it was meant to be.
4 out of 5 stars.
Yeah. 3.
Producer Dale is currently quaking in his boots at the back of the room. I have to say, my mum's a massive bookworm, but my dad doesn't read. My dad has read one book in his entire life, and that's Michael Heseltine's autobiography. I actually went on holiday with my parents this summer, just the three of us, and we haven't done that for 12 years. And it was joyous, and also quite trying. And I did have a moment of like, maybe it would be nice to give my mum a book so she can sit on a deck chair and enjoy the view for a couple of days, rather than asking me what we're going to eat. Basically, the minute that we're eating something, what are we going to eat next? And I gave her one day, and she started, and I was like, before I gave it to her, I was like, do you know what happens in this book? And she's like, no, I'm so excited. And I was like, have you watched the film? She said, no, can't wait. So then it was this horrible, like, bomb about to blow up. And I actually, like, because I'm so cruel, kind of live-tweeted the whole thing, where she started at 9 o'clock in the morning, and throughout the day she was just so blissfully happy. And I remember at one point she was like, God, what a love story. What a fun read. And then I remember at one point she went, oh! I went, what? And she said, he just said that he loved her in the maze. I was like, oh. Okay. And she was like, that was heavy going. I was like, yeah. And then she's like, what page are you on? And I just sat there and I just knew that she was going to fall apart. And then she did exactly what every other person who's ever read One Day did, where she kind of gasped and then just burst into tears and then put the book down. And then she cried for 40 minutes. Yeah. I know.
Dolly Alderton made her mum cry at Christmas.
And it didn't even like distract her for a long period because she kept checking in and, you know, narrating the book back to you.
Exactly. But that was one of those books, and everyone I know who's read that book is like, you read it in a day or 2 days because it's just those characters are so gorgeous and that plot is so cinematic. So, yeah, that's what I'd give to a troublesome family member.
There's a book I adore called Dear Mrs. Bird by A.J. Pearce. I think it came out maybe last year. This isn't festive, but with lots of old university pals, we went on holiday to Cyprus, and everyone is in the book world in some way. So we had our WhatsApp group, and we all planned our reading and made sure everyone's going to take a different book. We're all taking books we want to read to kind of really maximise baggage space. And someone brought Dear Mrs. Bird, but I think I'd been sent the hardback. And then my friend said, oh, I've got a proof. It's lighter. Don't bring the hardback. We can all read it. So we were passing this book around. But if you've not read it, it's about a very ambitious sort of girl who, it's the Second World War. She really, really, really desperately wants to be a journalist. And she sees this amazing job advertised where she can go and work for a magazine. And, you know, it's what she wants the most in the world. She's really desperate to help the war effort, but can't really do much because of, you know, systematic sexism. But I think she's she's volunteering. Gets the job, but it's not doing any kind of journalism. She's the assistant to the agony aunt, who also runs the magazine, the formidable Mrs. Bird, who makes it her life's mission to keep unpleasantness out of the agony aunt column. So it's the Second World War. So everyone is saying, I'm pregnant because I had a thing with someone in a bomb shelter, or, you know, my GI lover has gone back to America, or I'm really depressed and anxious because there's a war on, and, you know, sex and mental health, it's a no-go. So she starts answering these letters in secret, and it becomes quite clear that Mrs. Bird isn't even bothering to read her own column. So, you know, she is able to get away with it, but not indefinitely. But there's an incredibly sad bit, and I just remember sobbing and, you know, being like in a bikini on a towel and having nothing and having to blow my nose on the towel. And then, but we were all sat around the pool, and over the course of about 2 days from different places, you'd suddenly hear someone go, and we had to get new towels. So, characters in books that you love and hate, who do you want to invite round for a bit of turkey, mince pies, mulled wine? Who are you going to hide from if they knock at the door, you turn the lights off and you're behind the sofa?
Amy in Little Women.
Book burner. Book burner.
Amy can come round, but she's never getting in. That's my. That's the person I hate most in all literature. She's
really.
Wow. She burned Joe's book. She burned Joe's book.
It is shitty. You're right.
One copy.
I know.
Anyway,
you're right. Why do I love that book so much? You're right.
But I do think, you know, this idea, because you think, you know, oh, sisters, they love each other. I've got five younger sisters. I wrote a book about this, the sisterhood. And, you know, it's supposed to be all sweet and kind and loving. But no, you shouldn't do that to your sisters, but you do. You know what's going to hurt each other the most in the world, and you can push each other's buttons. But I don't blame you for excluding her from the celebrations.
But I thought who I'd invite. I'm going to invite for my Christmas dinner the whole of the inhabitants of Cold Comfort Farm.
We'll come on.
Wouldn't it be brilliant? You'd have everything. You'd have drama, you'd have a bit of sex, you'd have passion, you'd have Adam Lambsbreath cleaning the pans with his thorny twig afterwards. It would be so much more interesting than the average Christmas dinner. So that's just like
Flora would be one of those dreamy guests who comes with like two cases of champagne and sort of, you know, pots of truffles and things. Like, no, don't worry, darling, I've got this new, you know. In a blaze of sequins and
yes, she'd be perfect.
Capable and glamorous.
I would invite... Now, it's really hard to write characters in books who are good and nice but still interesting.
Yeah.
But I think Marilyn Robinson does that in Gilead with John Ames, and I love him so much. Ooh. The Reverend. Yeah, I love him so much. I'd so invite him. I just want to cook for him, and I can't even cook. So he'd get a salad, probably. Complicated salad, maybe. I would shut the door on Mary Poppins because, what a cold bitch.
I was so upset when I read the book of Mary Poppins. I can't even tell you.
Yeah. And also Fanny Price, because I recently reread Mansfield Park and she's a bit of a wet blanket.
Oh, she's wet.
Yeah, she's such a wet blanket.
Yeah. I am a Fanny Price apologist, and I know that's not a popular position to be in. But I will argue this out with you.
Yeah.
Yes, no. I want to hear.
Because also, could you, of all the people to shut out, who would take it more badly than Fanny Price? She is very vulnerable.
Oh, I'm such a cow, aren't I? I am Mary Poppins, aren't I? I shut myself out.
And you know, she'd be the one who would be, you know, while everybody at the Christmas dinner was being a self-absorbed nightmare, Fanny Price would be there just feeling terrible about everything and trying and failing to manage everyone's emotions. So maybe it's better for her that she doesn't have to endure
you've
that.
You've made me feel really bad now.
Good.
Yeah. Sorry, Fanny.
Shall we play charades? Oh, no, we can't. We can't because it's wrong.
It was a different time.
I think I would shut the door on Mr. Darcy just because he's a pompous, patronising mansplainer.
He'd give everyone Lincoln in the Bardo, wouldn't he?
I love that book.
He'd just be miserable, and I just really hate Mr. Darcy. This is like a whole other TED talk that I should do another time. And I would love to invite in not so much a character, but kind of a character with open arms, David Sedaris and Hugh.
Oh, that's a perfect one. We should talk about the Santaland Diaries, which have we all read? David Sedaris' essay about his time working in Macy's as a Christmas elf.
I haven't read that yet, and I'm desperate to. I've come to David Sedaris so late in life. I've only discovered him in the last kind of year, and he's been my highlight of 2019, if not the entire decade. But everything that I hear about his partnership with Hugh, I'm incredibly nosy about people's relationships, and they strike me as the kind of couple that would kind of detail everything about their worst arguments they've ever had. So I would just ply them with so much alcohol and listen intently.
The very end of Santaland Diaries, may I swear, would anyone be very upset if I dropped a big old F-bomb? So it's been a stressful time at Macy's, and David Sedaris is about to collect his final paycheck and go home, and he's trying to say goodbye to his manager, and his manager is having a fight at customer services with a woman who has had a disappointing experience at Macy's, and the manager is saying, fine, go to my boss, but don't tell him I called you a bitch. Tell him I called you a fucking bitch, because that's what you are. So,
would you have put up with Mr. Darcy for the house?
Pemberley.
It's a big house, you can hide from him.
I
That's a healthy relationship, eh?
How to Kill Your Husband.
That's a good idea. If you gave me that book, then
you
I could hang out
in
Pemberley.
You could have your own wing. I mean, it's not a question of, you know, just retreating to your room. Just thought.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I would. I mean, given the London property, yeah, I think I would. Yeah.
Yeah. Fair.
I'm glad you have principles.
Yeah. I suppose also what's not, I can't imagine Mr. Darcy being dramatic. You know, he'd be quite sort of salt. Maybe he's a little bit, you know, like, don't look at me, I'm shy. Don't look at me, I'm in a bad mood, while making everyone look at him. But he's not, you know, too... I think you could probably ignore him more easily than other people. Maybe not. Not like, you know, Heathcliff, I think, is just full on mad.
I actually was involved in a debate at Cheltenham Literary Festival. This is like the only room and the only platform where I can say this and not be totally cringed out, where Sebastian Faulks and I argued that Mr. Darcy was more of a shit than Heathcliff, but ultimately we lost. What would the room say? Who's the biggest shit, Heathcliff or Darcy?
Heathcliff.
Heathcliff. Well, because also, Mr. Darcy, for all of his faults, I think he's kind in a really practical way about Lydia. And I don't think Heathcliff is... You know, he's there when it matters.
I doubt Mr. Darcy would dig up Elizabeth's corpse. It's just a thought.
No, he's too boring, you're right.
That's what you want in a man, someone who'll dig up your corpse.
A bit of get up and go, do you know what I mean, ladies?
So... let's flash forward to the end of the month. I'm sorry to do this to you all, but it's time for resolutions chat. Do you have any reading resolutions for 2019?
I've quoted Proust at the beginning.
Sorry, 2020?
Did you say 2019?
I did say 2019. Or any reading resolutions that you made in 2019 that you kept or did not keep?
For next year, I've quoted Proust at the front of my novel that's coming out in 2020, which I think...
Is that because he's out of copyright?
You know me so well. The long battle that I had with quoting one bloody Smith song, bloody Morrissey. I've quoted that at the front, and that basically means I have to read some fucking Proust now.
I've just read the first two because I'm doing a podcast on Proust next Wednesday.
Round of applause for Lisa.
You're my heroine. You're going to save me.
I'd say the first one was bearable, and the second one, I just felt as... You know Marley in The Chains? You know? I just felt by page 590 or whatever that I was dragging an entire plot along with me. I don't think I'll be reading from three onwards.
But I could whip through. I could whip through round one. Do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. I just think that if you're quoting a really heavyweight writer at the front of your book, you have to have read a bit.
Yeah, I do think so. What did you quote?
It is our imagination that is responsible for love and not the other person. I mean, he's a clever fucker, isn't he? Clever, clever fucker.
Might read him.
I thought you were going to say... mine. And I was like, yeah, do you know what? You don't need to read Proust. You can just read my book that has a sentence with him at the front.
Because that means he will have technically read Proust.
Yeah, exactly.
What was the question again? Oh, yeah, reading resolutions, which you didn't... Oh. Is that your resolution to read
I've
Proust?
Got to read Proust, yeah.
Yeah. I am really bad at abandoning books that I'm not enjoying. I feel like I have to get to the end, and one of these days I want to be the type of person that can just give up without feeling bad about it. So that's what I think I'll do in 2020.
Are there any books that you've wished you've given up on in places and then got to the end and been glad you did?
Handmaid's Tale.
Ah!
I read that quite a few years ago now, maybe 10, 15 years ago. And I found it really, really hard going until three quarters of the way in. And I was like, oh, this is quite good, isn't it?
She's not
Maggie.
That bad.
Yeah, she's not that bad. And actually, I'm glad I didn't give that up.
Did you read The Testaments? Or are you going to?
No, I am going to, yeah, at some point.
I mean, that's something that I was... I'm not sure if I can say this. I think a disappointment for me in 2019. It was fun. It was great, but it was a bit too... I don't think it was as dark as it needed to be. But maybe given that... Because real life is so dark, maybe it couldn't be. But I felt very strongly that... because I loved Girl, Woman, Other. And I think that, you know, Bernardine Evaristo should not have had to share that prize. That is the my hobby horse of the year, and I'm sticking to it, but it's unrelated.
To be fair, I think Margaret Atwood wrote the testaments hoping everyone would say it's fun.
A romp.
My resolution is the same as the last about 5 or 6 years, and that's to read Ulysses. So I think you ask me again in a year and it'll be the same resolution. I've still just not quite managed it.
Are you going to pick up where you left off, or do you start anew every time?
No, I start anew every time. But the book that I'm really looking forward to this year is Hilary Mantel, The Mirror and the Light. Oh, God, I'm looking forward to that. And I'm going to reread the other two before it comes out.
So is that part of the Wolf Hall world?
I mean, I held out on Wolf Hall for ages. And then I started reading it a couple of years ago. I thought, why have I not read this? I loved it so much. I loved it so much that as I was reading it, it felt like a lovely job. And I thought, I could be happy to go and read Wolf Hall every day. You know, that's my job. And it was just, I was overwhelmed by it. Because I've loved Hilary Mantel for a long time, but I have to say, and this is, you know, a writer talks, I don't think she can do plot. I really don't. A lot of her early books are wonderfully written, but they've often the end is all over the place. Anyway, I find them frustrating. But because she's got a plot, she's been given a plot for Wolf Hall. It's based on a real person. I think it's just magnificent. I think it's used all her finest talents. You know, she's able to utilise that genius.
Oh, she's hitting her marks. Because I feel ashamed that I've never read Wolf Hall. God, and whenever so it comes up, I go, Wolf Hall, very good.
It's story after story. It's a wonderful story. I mean, it's fantastic.
And they don't spend too much time saying, it was Tudor time, so everything smelled of dung and going to the toilet was out of the window.
Do you know what? It feels contemporary, not in that it's a contemporary book, but it feels as if you are there. It's not looking back. You are there in that world. So they don't have to. People in wartime books shouldn't go around saying, oh, it was a Bakelite switch, you know. You're there. You only notice the things that are worth noticing.
I tried to run, but there was no elastic, so my clothes were constricting me.
David Nichols talks about that kind of writing because Sweet Sorrow was set in the 90s and he said he wanted to avoid space hopper writing. Mm. And I think it is such a temptation, isn't it, to kind of constantly root your reader into exactly where you are, but it actually just jolts you out of it so quickly.
Mad for it, said he, with a mouthful of spangles. But I think that might be my reading resolution now. Wolf Hall, not as terrifying as we might think. So, I guess the last question, favourite book of this year?
Oh, that's a tricky one. I just recently read Daisy Jones and the Six.
I loved that book.
So good. I just can't bear it because it's structural genius, and I think structure is so hard to get right when you're writing a book, and I thought it was amazing. And
also, did you have that thing when you read it as a writer where you're like, why didn't I think of that?
Yeah, I was
which
like,
is
bitch.
So annoying. Yeah, it's such a good,
it's really brilliant
premise.
And I just recently started reading Anita Bruckner. I read Hotel du Lac, which I loved.
I love Hotel du Lac.
And then I read Look at Me.
I love that one.
Yeah, so I love that. And I also started reading Barbara Pym.
Which one?
Excellent Women.
Oh, very good. I love Barbara.
She's like the original Lena Dunham, I think.
Oh, I hate Lena Dunham.
But like just that kind of like, you know, brilliantly, sharply observed.
It's a bit like Big Little Lies. Who's read the book? Which is also really brilliant structurally. So it's that kind of idea of interviewing people, but this actually doesn't have any authorial voice, which is amazing because you get swept into the whole 70s scene without feeling like she's missing a beat.
And I was so jealous when I was reading it because it almost reads like you're reading the transcript of a documentary. Mm. And the bit, now that I'm writing fiction, the bit that I find so difficult and laborious and I'm so bad at doing, to the point where I often just leave out chunks like a collage and just go back to it at the end, is the bit where you're kind of moving people around and when you're...
Getting them out of the room.
Getting them out of the room.
Taking days. Yeah.
Getting to
moving
go to
them
the...
across a room.
Yes. Going to a different room, going to the fridge, making a cup of tea. And I think the thing that I love... I also do screenwriting, and the thing that I love about screenwriting is
you don't have to describe anything exactly. You just, it's people saying funny things and interesting characters and things developing and all that kind of moving around and description. You know, you just, I remember writing a script recently where I was writing a man, I was introducing a man, and normally in fiction that would be like, if it was a leading character, that would be like a couple of pages for me because I overwrite so much. But I literally just wrote, Greg, 44, has a no man-made fibres, natural deodorant sort of a vibe. That was it. That's all I needed to write about Greg. So yeah, that's why I got really jealous when I was reading Daisy Jones and the Six.
Lisa, do you have any favourite?
My favourite book this year. I read almost as much non-fiction as I read fiction, so I've chosen a non-fiction book, and it's the book I've thought about all year, and it's just joyous. It's called Waterlogged by Roger Deakin, and he was a joyful swimmer, and he was a naturalist as well, and he lived in Norfolk Farm, which had its own moat, which was just a big sort of, you know, a pool dug in the 17th century. And he would swim up and down every day. And he decided to sort of swim the UK. And Roger was so tough. Roger would plunge into anything. And he starts by swimming around the Channel Islands. And then if Roger sees a pool, he gets in it. So he'll be on Dartmoor, he'll swim somewhere, he'll swim down a chalk stream, he'll swim, you know, in a lime street, lime, what's the word? Limestone sort of streams.
And
quarries. He'll swim anywhere. And it's full of the absolute joy of swimming. It's really interesting as well because it's one of these early psychogeography books. So it tells you a lot about the country, it tells you a lot about him. But mainly, it's about the joy of swimming outdoors, and it's just gorgeous. And he's funny, and he's interesting, and I can't recommend it highly enough. Classic bedside book.
I am sold. Dolly, what is your book of the year?
I think that I'll choose nonfiction as well. I think mine is My Name Is Why by Lem Sisso, which is an unbelievably moving book, and has kind of stuck with me for still sort of I think about all the time, and I read it months ago, and it's a memoir that he wrote about his kind of mistreatment by the authorities with his adoption when he was very young. And the thing that makes it really, really powerful is not only he kind of punctuates it with his beautiful poetry that relates to these like very cruel and unbearable circumstances of abuse and abandonment that he finds himself in, but he also uses as kind of breaks between chapters documentation of social workers and authorities and all the various institutions that he was passed around in, all these official documents where he's being observed as a young boy and a teenager, and he kind of reacts and responds and comments on them with his version, which is the truth. And he only got his hands on that documentation very recently, after like 20 years of trying to find out the truth of why his mother gave him up for adoption, which he ultimately found out was against her will. So it's not a light read. I found it very traumatic, but it is totally beautiful. And there's a poem in it that I still think about all the time, which is about the four lines, which is... I actually can't remember. It is.
I was about to be seriously impressed.
It was. I will build an embassy in your heart over time. There is a plot of land inside me. Build one in mine.
Very sweet, very serious note to end on.
Sorry.
And I've asked you this impossible question because I don't think I could pick my book, which is mean of me to put you in this book. But a writer that people have told me to read for a long time, and I'm like, yeah, I'll get around to it, and then have discovered this year and thought, why has it taken me so long? I read the short stories of Lucia Berlin, and
I haven't read Lucia Berlin.
They are astonishing, and it's this sort of mix of writing that is at times bordering on the poetic, but also very like vivid and sharp. And she had the most extraordinary life, and I think the stories are semi-autobiographical. So she was, I believe, from a very grand family in South America, and then she ended up in the United States in sort of strained circumstances. She had a long and difficult history with addiction and drugs and alcohol. She was romantically involved with a lot of addicts and had a family, and their relationships were sort of chaotic, although I think she had two sons who remained very close to her, and her youngest son wrote the introduction for the new collection of stories. One is called A Manual for Cleaning Women, and I cannot remember what the other newer one is, but it's very, very good. But it's really, really vivid, because I get quite grumpy if someone's describing a tree for two pages. I think, anyone can do, anyone knows different ways of describing a leaf. But she really is, you know, the sand and the sky and the desert, and the scent of her is what the scent of her world. Well, I want to say the hugest thank you to my fabulous, fabulous festive panellists, Dolly, Aisha and Lisa. Can we have a huge round of applause, please? I also need to say an enormous thank you to everybody at Albright, to the Tape Agency, and to everyone who supported the podcast in the last year. We're only a year old, and it's been such a fun year. We've just recorded our US, I was going to say our US America series, our Your Booked America series. There's a tautology for you. So that will be coming to your ears in the new year. And this is going up, plus another Christmas surprise. If you don't know the podcast and you're here for the first time, it's called Your Booked. Again, it's us going to authors' houses. We've got really episodes I adore that are up with Dolly and Aisha, which you can listen to in our back catalogue, and Lisa's episode is coming up in the new year, and it's great. And finally, I want to say the biggest thank you to producer Dale, who hasn't just been doing the sound today, but is one of my favourite humans and writers. And everyone here has a fabulous book. Please go out and buy, give it as a gift. Everything I Know About Love by Dolly, published by Fig Tree. Aisha's many books are fabulous. This Green and Pleasant Land is one of my favourites this year, and that is published by Bunnier. And Lissa, Old Baggage, and also really beautiful children's books. I think children, it's very hard to buy books for them, and children will find them very, very funny, as will you. And producer Dale's excellent new book, Painfully British Haikus, published by Michael Joseph, which is a must for all of your awkward relatives.
I co-signed that. I was reading it this weekend.
And I have been Daisy Buchanan. And thank you so much for coming and getting Christmassy with us all.
Thank you so much to our fabulous guests, Dolly, Aisha and Lissa. Do rush out and buy their brilliant books immediately and give them to all of your favourite people for Christmas. Huge thanks to everyone at Albright and the Tape Agency for bringing this event together. And thank you so much for listening. It has been a privilege to have borrowed your ears throughout 2019. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can buy our books too. The Sisterhood is published by Headline, and producer Dale's new book, Painfully British Haikus, is published by Michael Joseph. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. For any queries about the podcast, please email whybooked@gmail.com or talk to us on social media. I'm @NotRollerGirl on Twitter and @TheDaisyBee on Instagram. Say hello, suggest some guests, and watch out for shelfies. I leave you with this from Garrison Keillor. A lovely thing about Christmas is that it's compulsory, like a thunderstorm, and we all go through it together.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.